are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The wheels of justice turn slowly but grind exceedingly fine. Renee Fair knew that Gregory Hauser killed her sister Cheryl. There was not a single doubt in her mind. Yet for 27 years, Hauser walked free. But Renee wouldn't rest until he was convicted for murder. The wheels of justice is equal parts the story of a monstrous killer, a harrowing look at domestic violence, and an inspirational story of a family that wouldn't quit until justice prevailed. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Wheels of Justice, the true story of a 27-year battle to convict my sister's killer, with my special guest, attorney and author, Renee Fair. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Renee Fair.
Hi, Dan, and good evening, and thank you for having me on your show this evening.
Thank you so much for this incredible story, The Wheels of Justice, a very personal story for you and your family, especially. Let's talk about your early life like you do in the book. In Farmer City, Illinois, a small town, Illinois, 2,000 population, you say, and tell us about this life with your three sisters and your mom and dad. Tell us how life was and what it was like, and tell us a little bit about your family.
Yeah, so I am the third of four girls. Victor and Phyllis Fair are our parents. My dad, go figure, was a farmer in Farmer City, Illinois, and my mother was a nurse. She'd started out being a pediatric nurse, and then when we moved to Farmer City, became a nurse in the local nursing home. You have to remember this was back in the late 80s, early 90s, and we didn't have, you know, on a good day, if we juggled the antenna just right, we got three stations for TV, no video games or anything like that. And my dad farmed and had four girls, so he still expected us to be outside and do chores and work with him, and that's what we loved. We loved being outside and playing on the farm. Cheryl was the oldest, probably a very stereotypical firstborn. She was a little quiet and shy, very compliant, very sweet. I like to say that if you believe in angels on earth, Cheryl was probably one of those. And that became evident early in her life. She was the biggest animal lover that ever existed. And there was not a pet or an animal that was found on the farm, you know, a bird that fell out of a nest or a ground squirrel or even a raccoon that fell out of a tree that she couldn't adopt and nurse back to health and make into one of our family pets.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about what she decided to do. She was a senior in high school when someone took an interest from the neighboring town of Mansfield. But where were she was your older sister. Tell us about this meeting that your sister had while she was a senior in high school. Who did she meet?
Yeah, so she was the oldest. We were, Cheryl and my second sister, Lisa, were 2 years apart, and then Lisa and I were just 18 months apart. And then my younger sister, Julie, was 3 years younger than me. And, you know, Cheryl, being the oldest, was kind of the leader of all of us, and she didn't really take an interest in boys, or boys didn't take an interest in her until she got into high school. And she was a senior in high school. Farmer City is a small town. Mansfield, was an even smaller town. The schools had consolidated, so we went to junior high. You went to your own towns for grade school, and then junior high, everybody went to Mansfield. And then when you went to your 4 years of high school, everybody came to Farmer City. So Greg would have been maybe 2 years ahead of Cheryl and in high school. So they would have met perhaps in junior high, but definitely by the time they get to high school, they've met. And classes back then were, you know, from 60 to 75, 80 people. So, you know, I think that's a pretty small high school class. So everybody knows everybody, not only within your class, but within the high school. And, you know, we first became knowledgeable of Greg because Cheryl started to date him her senior year in high school. And he started to come around the house. And, you know, to my sisters and I, that was fun. We had, you know, not experienced boys and not been exposed to them. And you're pretty secluded out in the country and, you know, you're not driving. And all of our neighbors that were, you know, up and down our road were little girls. They were all little girls in the neighborhood, and we played together, but just had not had a lot of exposure to boys. So it was fun because when Greg started to come around and pay attention to Cheryl, he had, you know, guy friends that came around too. And so Lisa and I thought that was, you know, really fun and interesting. And we were getting older, and so we were taking an interest in older boys who, you know, would take an interest in us and with Cheryl. You know, I think that because, you know, all she was such a sweet person, and she was going to go on to be a nurse. And there's no surprise in that. I mean, she was your typical caregiver, your fixer, you know, an enabler in essence. And she did go to nursing school to nurse babies. So not only did she want to do that, but she wanted to get married and have babies of her own. And I mean, that's what she wanted to do because she loved babies, baby animals and baby human beings. And so when Greg took an interest in her, it was a big deal. And I think that was her, I finally found somebody and now I'm going to live out the rest of my dream. I'll go to college and then I'll get married and have my own babies.
Right. What was Greg's background and where was his career headed? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, he was older than me, so I didn't really know him growing up until he encountered Cheryl. I know that he was born and raised in Mansfield. It's a town of 800. His dad owned and ran the local FS station. It was a gas station, farm service gas station, you know, on a pretty prevalent corner in Mansfield. And Greg, well, his mother was the local Avon lady. I remember that. And Greg was going to, from as far back as I remember, get out of high school, go to a local junior college, become a diesel mechanic, and be a mechanic, not just an auto mechanic like his father, but work on, you know, diesel equipment, either farm equipment or trucks. And he went on to work on trucks.
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of a stereotypical, in a sense, bad guy or tough guy. He liked fast cars. He had a gold Trans Am that he sped around in and would drive into the house. He liked big trucks, had a truck that he, you know, entered in mud bog races and, you know, did things like that. So definitely, you know, back then I would have said, you know, he was cool.
What was the behavior? I know that... Again, you mentioned that you didn't really have experience around boys, and you were younger than your sister, but you did see some behavior that was at least, looking back, you might have questioned. And so what was some of the things that you noticed in terms of how he spoke about your sister in front of his other sisters, or your other sisters?
Yeah, I remember it, and I remember talking to my sister Lisa about it, where, you know, you don't know what you don't know, and you didn't get taught healthy versus unhealthy relationships in health class back in the late 80s, early 90s. And we hadn't been exposed, so, you know, you don't know what you don't know. Greg comes around, and he's kind of cool, and he's got fast cars, and he's dating our sister, and we think that's neat. And he's trying to, I think, win us over, because he takes time to pay attention to us and tease us or interact with us a bit. But as we started to all interact more, a lot of his teasing and fun and interaction was at Cheryl's expense. So, you know, he teased her, you know, to the point where you would see that hurt look in her eyes, you know, but he didn't stop. Or he'd tickle her until she cried. You're sitting there going, oh, that must just be how it is. You know, we don't know any different, but we don't really like that, because you see the hurt in your sister's eyes. There was,
right.
It didn't matter how long she spent getting ready or putting, she wasn't a big makeup person, but if she was going out for a date or something, she put on makeup and we would help her put on makeup. And he always found a flaw in it or criticized her or told her she looked stupid with makeup on. I mean, it just, and that, again, we saw the hurt in her, and then we're sitting there going, well, that's not nice, you know, but maybe that's how it is. And as time went on, it got to the point where we would even have the conversation of, look, I don't know that I really like this guy, but if our sister chooses him, we're not, who are we to interfere in her relationship? And so we're going
right.
to love our sister, and we're going to support our sister.
Right.
Yeah, it really, I think that one of the biggest turning events for me was finding out that a cat that I had who went missing that we searched for forever and ever, and finally another friend of Greg's was there and said, stop searching for the cat. The cat is dead. Greg shot it and threw it in the pasture. I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? Yeah, it walked on his car and he didn't like that, you know? And that was just, okay, that's not okay. You don't
right.
you don't kill somebody's pet because it walked across your car. And,
sure.
you know, you just didn't even know, I just didn't even know how to take that.
Mm-hmm. You say despite all of these things, but your sister, after high school, she became engaged to Greg. And you said it was really her only real boyfriend she ever had. She finished her nurse's training and she graduated, and they married. She graduated in May and they married in June in Farmer City. They rented a little
yeah.
house, and their first son, Brandon, was born 9 months after. And they lived pretty close to Lisa, so she got to see the boys quite often. What were you doing at this time, and where was your career headed?
Yeah, so once I graduated from high school, I went to Illinois Wesleyan University, and from the time I was in high school, I had declared, for really an unknown reason, I was going to be a lawyer. I didn't have anybody in the family, but that's what I wanted to do. I liked to solve problems. I was good at solving problems, and to me, that's what you did for a profession, if that were the characteristic. So I went to Wesleyan and was pretty persistent even back then, wanted to get on with my career. It was expensive. Law school was expensive. So I set forth a schedule and was able to graduate from Illinois Wesleyan in 3 years and then start law school in St. Louis. And so, you know, I was pretty dedicated and driven and on a career path where, you know, I leave to go to college, I leave to go to law school. Law school takes me to Florida because I follow my boyfriend at the time, ends up being my first husband, to Florida. And so while we're close, we're extremely close family, And I was the only one who moved away, you know, whoever really left. And that was always hard, but we remained really close. And, you know, as Cheryl was, go ahead.
You talk about being close while you were away, and your sister is married. She's having children. She's had her firstborn, and a couple years later had her next born, or 3 years later, pardon me. What are the kinds of conversations? You're long distance. You're not around, so you're close to your sisters, Lisa and Julie. What are the kinds of conversations you're having regarding your sister's relationship with Greg?
You know, then it was all about, you know, Cheryl and the boys, her babies. You know, she's the first one to get married, and she's the first one who had kids. And so when I talk to, you know, my mom, it's, hey, have you seen Cheryl and the boys? What have they been up to? When I talked to Lisa, we talked a little bit personally, but it was always, you know, what have you done with Cheryl and the boys, and have you seen them lately? Because that was, you know, that was the focus. That was fun, and she was the first that had gotten married and was going to go on to live this fairy tale life and live out her dream. And she would send me, I felt bad because we were a close family, and that meant we celebrated, you know, birthdays and holidays and Labor Day and Memorial Day and 4th of July, everything, you know, together. Usually meant we got together at my mom and dad's house, and everybody came over, and we ate, and we played outside, and they took pictures. And any of those events usually had a phone call during it or after it so that I could catch up on what happened. And then, I mean, I have stacks of pictures that, you know, Cheryl would send to me. Back then there was no email and or text. And so she literally would get photos developed and send them to me with a handwritten note of, you know, it was the oldest birthday and we had it at grandma's and here's the pictures and we had a pinata and here they are looking like they're going to kill each other with a bat. You know, it was right. Those fun events that I missed out on, but I never felt like I missed out on them because they were so good about, you know, keeping me included as best they could, even though I lived 1,800 miles away.
Mm-hmm. Your mother was diagnosed with cancer at some point, and you say that the conversations that you and Cheryl had never really hinted at anything, there being any kind of problem, let alone this incredible abuse that she was enduring. So what changed and why when your mother was diagnosed with cancer? What was the change for Cheryl?
You know, it's my opinion, but I think that was a big change and a big event for her. I think that Cheryl knew that if she was ever going to leave Greg and be able to live on her own and away from him, that she needed my mom. You know, she needed my mom to be there. She needed my mom for, you know, moral support. And she needed my mom's help with the boys because she worked. And so I think that is one of the instrumental things in Cheryl's decision to finally leave Greg. And it ends up, the cancer diagnosis was a misdiagnosis. So, again, you know, a blessing in disguise, but that was before, that was in the summer, and by July, Cheryl has called me around the 4th of July and asked me for an attorney referral, which wasn't unusual. I was now a year out of law school, and the family would call and ask me legal questions for them, you know, not so much for themselves, but for other people or friends or other family. And she called and asked for if I could help her find a divorce attorney in Champaign, Illinois. And I'm like, yeah, sure, you know, because it wasn't unusual. And I asked her like I normally would, well, who's it for? And she said, with a bit of a pause, me. I was stunned, floored, because, I mean, we're Catholic. We don't get divorced. Nobody in my family had been divorced. and she had three kids. And to me, you have three kids, you can't get divorced. I had no idea of anything that she was going through. You know, hindsight's 20/20, and I look back and signs, now that I'm much more educated too with domestic violence, there were signs there, but we didn't know. We didn't know what was happening. And she was very, very secretive about it. It starts, the terrifying part of the story starts, you know, with that call and referral and me telling her, you can't get divorced. I told her that. I said, I might help you find an attorney, but you have to go to a counselor first. Have you been to a counselor? And she was such a compliant, non-confrontational person. You know, she didn't even say, you know, Renee, you have no idea what I'm going through. You have to help me get out of this. She just said, okay, I've been to counseling, but we haven't been together. I guess we can try going to marriage counseling. And so she did. I mean, she helped her find a counselor, and she went off to marriage counseling. And, you know, I can remember being very proud of myself because she's now going to go to marriage counseling, and she's going to fix her marriage, and it's all going to be fine, and she's going to continue her little fairy tale life raising her three boys. And it wasn't too long after that, I hear Cheryl tells me, oh, they've been going to counseling. They're going to take a little trip to Peoria. They're going to take the boys and stay in a hotel, and they're going to swim and go to the zoo. And I thought, oh, that's so awesome. They've fixed it. They've worked this out. And then I call Lisa, and I'm like, hey, Cheryl went, you know, to Peoria for the weekend. Did they have a good time? And I'll never forget, she said, Renee, she came back with hickeys all over her neck. I'm like, oh, what? Yes. And that was just another, like, major moment in my life of, oh, my God, he's just her, like, she's, like, he's a dog and she's a piece of property or something. And, I mean, and that wasn't Cheryl. Cheryl was a professional. She was a nurse. She was self-conscious enough. You know, she was married. She had children. I'm sure she would have been horrified. I'm sure she was horrified and embarrassed by that. But that's, you know, that's when, again, things changed for me. And I called her back and I'm like, okay, I've got this guy. He's really good. And her biggest concern was, is he going to be good with custody? Because if I leave Greg, he's going to fight me to the bitter end for custody. And nothing was more important than her babies. And by now she has three of them, and she's like, I can't lose my babies. There's nothing more important to me than those kids. So, you know, now she's got a good divorce attorney, and she tells him she wants to leave him. And, you know, it was really from that moment on, from early in July until October 5th, where everything just was escalated and almost like some horror film, because he's not going to lose control. There's just no way. He is so angry with her that he ends up filing for a divorce first and then begs her to stay, you know, and it's like, well, you just filed. But it was all, you know, and then she starts to confide just little bits and pieces in us, and that's when we really, you know, little by little start to realize that she's been living in a secret hell, and now we're seeing it play out, because now it's not behind closed doors. It's happening in other places, and Cheryl's letting us in.
To counter her attempts to get custody of the children, and he threatens that he will get custody of her, of the children himself, what are some of the things he does, you say the dirty tricks that he does to try to attempt to get some leverage in this custody case?
You know, one of the first things, I think there were probably multiple, I know there were multiple altercations in the marriage, but now we're at this point, there's altercations, and she's decided you know, if she's really going to do this. I had coached her on, you know, here I am a young lawyer, but I've learned one thing, and that is if you're going to go into a custody battle, you better document it all, you know. And so I had coached her on that. Get a notebook, I don't care what it is, and write it down. Write it all down. Just keep track of it, because someday if you have to testify or it comes up, it's going to be really important. And again, very dutifully, she picked up her kindergarten Spider-Man notebook and started taking notes in it, dating it and taking notes. And she's a nurse, and so you read this, and, you know, I call it her journal. It's really not a diary. And it's written a lot like, you know, she's documenting a case at, you know, in the hospital, or documenting patient's care. And she even uses some of the same symbols and stuff. But she's because she is a nurse, I think she's able to be very factually detailed, and she's very graphic. But it's unemotional that she just documents everything. So she has started to document all of this. And so now she's telling me bits and pieces, but in hindsight, I've been able to read the entire journal. And he knew the kids were her soft spot. And so he just kept telling her, you know, you're a bad mother. Every time they get a bruise or a cut or a scratch, I'm taking a picture. I'm going to tell everybody you've abused your children, that you're abusive. I'm going to tell people that you're using drugs, accused her of drug abuse. You know, I'm going to tell people you're having an affair. It was just, I think, in my mind, in hindsight, I think everything that he was doing, he accused her of and said she was doing. And so she was always on the defensive. And it was always about, oh, my God, I can't, you know, this child's fallen down. He's got a bruise on his face. He takes a picture of it. She's like, you know, he just fell. He's 3 years old, and he's rambunctious, and he fell. You know, but she was always on the defensive and just trying to be perfect and starting to run around and go, okay, he's saying I use drugs. I'm going to go have a drug test and, you know, find out that I don't use drugs. And he says I'm doing this, and I'm going to prove him wrong. And it would just was continually escalating with to the point where there's altercations, the cops are called, there's a battery charge against him. But he files the first motion for a restraining order because she fought back, right? And he gets the first restraining order. It's like, here he is, always kind of one step ahead of her. But then there's more abuse, and she goes and gets a restraining order. And then there's, you know, more abuse, and the judge enters a mutual restraining order, but he says, okay, I'm going to leave the kids in the house, but both of you, and you will rotate in and out of the house every 3.5 days. Very different back then. They wouldn't do that today, but now you've got the same people living in the same home with the same access, you know, in and out of the house. And then, you know, so, and while all this is happening, she's calling me. She's given me permission to talk to her attorney so I can try and, you know, cut through some of the legal jargon or help him, help her, because she also didn't have, you know, any money, and I wanted to save her money if I could help, you know, save fees and expenses. So it was just, it was very intense where she's calling me, and then she's also leaning a lot on my mother, and my mother's calling me, you know, so oftentimes it would be, you know, a call from Cheryl and a call from my mother, and it was almost the same story. Cheryl would never ask for help, but she's telling me these things, and I'm trying to help her, and then my mother would call and say, did you talk to Cheryl today? Do you know what happened to her today and what he's doing, and, you know, what can we do about this, and we've got to make him stop. This is awful. You know, bad things are going to happen, and that just takes that escalation path. Up to the point of, I like to say, there was a altercation where, now I refer to it as the first time he tried to kill her. He's in the home. He's got the children. Her smallest one has asthma, And he calls and says, you know, he's coughing and you probably should come by on your way home from work and check on him. She's like, well, no, I really shouldn't. It's not my turn to be in the house. Oh, it's okay. I promise it's okay. You can come in the house. She calls a couple times. I'm not going to get off on time. I'm going to be too late. I shouldn't come. He begs her to come. So she ends up stopping by and the lights are off, but she walks in the house and she doesn't even know that anybody's really there. And he comes up behind her and gets her into the bedroom where he has already tied yellow rope to the head of the bed, to the bed headboard. And,
right.
You know, ends up tying her up on the bed and sexually assaulting her. And, you know, the kids are there. All three of them are there. She was allowed at one point earlier to console a child and put him back in bed. But they're, you know, this is a small house. They're just a few feet, one door, you know, down in another bedroom. So that she writes of that and in her journal, she actually says, you know, I've always been able to talk him down and talk him out of it, but I saw the look in his eyes and I knew he could really kill me. And so to me, that was the first time where she always thought she could handle him. And she would say that to me, I can handle him. I can handle it. I can deal with this. But I think she really, this time, gets scared. She does manage to get away. He grabs her, you know, it's like a horror movie. She's trying to run to the door and he's grabbing her jacket and stuff and gets her and bends her over the back of the couch and has a piece of paper. And he's written on there, I consented to have sex, consensual sex with you. And he wants her to sign this paper. And she's like, I'm not signing it. I'm not signing anything. And they're fighting to get away. She finally gets out a front door and doesn't get in her car, which is sitting in the driveway. I think she's just too terrified. And she runs like a quarter mile down the road to the neighbor's house and bangs on the door. And they open it and let her in. And the cops are called. And now he's arrested again, and this time charged with aggravated criminal sexual assault. You know, so again, this case has really escalated. But I can remember calling her like the next day and hearing this all from her, hearing this from my mother, and saying, but Cheryl, I know that was awful, but sometimes bad things have to happen before something good can happen, and I'm sorry, but
Wow. With
that having happened, you are not going to lose custody of your kids. This is it. He's done himself in. And that was her biggest fear. So to me, this was, okay, he's now shown himself. She doesn't have to worry about custody. So she was pretty thrilled with that. Then she goes to, at her attorney's request, to get an emergency order, you know, of custody. This guy's trying
right.
to kill her. He shouldn't have custody of the kids. And so there is a hearing, which ends up being super instrumental because they put her on the stand and she testifies to that night, you know, very immediately after it happens and
right.
and goes through everything personally about what he tried to do to her and her injuries and how terrified she was of him. And that hearing happens and the judge at the end of it grants her temporary custody, sole and exclusive custody of the children in the home, and only awarded him supervised visitation. So he didn't even have just standard visitation. He had to be with another member of Department of Children and Family Services to visit the children. So again, Cheryl and I are pretty elated with, you know, now this has happened and it looks like things are going to fall in place. And she started to get a little bit, I'd almost say cocky, because she was proud of herself. She didn't know that she could get through this. It was awful. And now she's kind of got the upper hand because she's got custody of the kids. And, you know, she's going to win on that point. She's going to get the kids. And, you know, now we know, right, when you're trying to get away, that's probably the time when you're in the most danger.
Yes.
But she started making plans for the future and, you know, getting very excited, started packing his things and putting them in a area of the house, and started even delivering, you know, having his mother come pick up some things of his. She started to, I need another car because my car doesn't get good gas mileage and I'm afraid I won't be able to afford it on my own. So she was looking for that. She knew she couldn't afford the house, so she was looking for an apartment. She had gone to a local furniture store and put a bed on layaway because it was super important to her not to sleep in that same marital bed. She wanted a new bed. You know, Halloween is coming up, and she's ordered the kids' Halloween costumes, and she's really I'm starting to see my old Cheryl back, where there's a little sparkle in her eye again and a little spunk, and I think she sees light at the end of the tunnel.
Right. It looks like that Greg realizes, though, that these charges that are coming up, this trial impending, could land him in prison and without the custody of his boys as well. Let's use this as an opportunity, Renee, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. According to Forbes, gyms, nail salons, hotels, mom-and-pop stores, and more are set to go on an epic hiring spree in the coming months to meet the pent-up demand for all of these services. I was excited to go to the movie theater again, and I wanted to see a movie, and I saw Stillwater. And I was dying to go to the beach again and swim, and I saw some stand-up comedy. All of these businesses reopening means that millions of jobs will need to be filled. So where do these businesses turn to fill these roles fast? ZipRecruiter. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, they send your job to over 100 top job sites, giving you access to their network of millions of job seekers. ZipRecruiter's matching technology scans resumes to find qualified candidates for your open roles and proactively presents them to you. ZipRecruiter's technology is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/ M-U-R-D-E-R. M-U-R-D-E-R. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, Renee, we were just talking about the lead-up to this incredible murder. Let's talk about what happens just before this, October 5th, 1990, leading up to this. Tell us what happens and how you hear about it.
So, you know, Cheryl and I have had our little celebration. She's making her plans to go forward. My mom's a little bit relieved, too, up to that point. I mean, I'm like, gosh, he's going to kill her. And my mom thought, you know, he's going to kill her. And then when he did try, we're like, oh, my God, he was really going to kill her. But we're feeling a little bit of relief. But he's not going to, you know, he's not going to let this go. He'd already told her, if I can't have you, no one else can. He'd made, you know, very specific threats to her. So I'm now thinking, though, that there's a bit of a reprieve. And my parents are, too. But October 5th, I'm in Florida working for a law firm. I remember specifically the case I was working on, and I just hung up the telephone and, you know, felt somebody looking at me and looked up in my doorway, and there was my husband. He was standing there. And for a minute, I'm like, what in the world? Because that was very out of place, right? He didn't belong in my doorway in shorts and a T-shirt during the middle of the morning.
No.
And I could tell that he had, you know, like tears, dried tears on his face. And I looked at him, and I mean, my initial reaction was, I screamed. He killed her, didn't he? I knew he was going to kill her. I told you he was going to kill her. He killed her, didn't he? And he just looked at me and shook his head. Yes. So, and he hadn't even said anything. He just appeared. And I gathered my things and ran out of there. And, you know, back then we didn't have cell phones. And so I'm like, you know, what happened? He's like, Lisa called me. They found Cheryl dead. We've got to go home, pack our stuff, and get to Illinois. And, you know, right then I'm trying to figure out the details. He doesn't know many of the details. I have an hour drive from where he picked me up back to where we live. And I'm like, what about the boys? Who has the boys? Does my mom and dad know? I had 50,000 questions, and the poor guy, you know, was shell-shocked to hear and then had to drive an hour to come pick me up and take me back. And, you know, we're trying to figure out how we're going to get plane tickets that day back to Illinois. And I had just gotten out of law school and worried about the costs and all of that. But when I get back to our condo, I call my sister, and the first thing was, where are the boys? And she said, you know, Jackie has them, that's the neighbor. And I'm like, okay, you got to go get them. You got to go get the boys and hide the boys. I don't know what's happening, what's going on, but we've got to keep them safe. And I'm thinking in my mind, you know, Greg may have taken them from the scene or not, and we need to make sure that they're safe. Because I then find out that that morning, Cheryl didn't show up for work. She was a nurse. She was supposed to be there for her shift change. She was always, you know, timely and didn't ever not show up. And the nurses that she worked with, you know, she can find little bits and pieces in a lot of different people, but not a lot in everybody or any one person. And when she didn't show, one of the ladies got so concerned that she called Cheryl's house and nobody answered. And so that concerned her, you know, even more. She hung up, called back, and let it ring again. And this time, a child answered, and she recognized it as being Cheryl's oldest, so he would have been 6. And she asked, you know, where's your mommy? He said, I don't know. And she said, well, put down the phone, go look for your mommy, find your mommy, and either bring her back to the phone or come back to the phone and tell me where she's at. And so he was gone for what she says seemed like forever. I'm sure it wasn't that long, but he came back to the phone and was almost proud. He says, I found my mommy. She's asleep in the garage with a rope around her neck.
Yeah.
And immediately the nurse, you know, kept him on the phone and then had another nurse dial 911. Now, that night, interestingly enough, Greg had stayed overnight with his grandparents who lived about, you know, a block or two, little blocks in Mansfield away from his parents where he'd been staying.
Mm-hmm.
He later testifies in a deposition that he hasn't stayed with his grandparents since he was like 11. So now he stayed overnight with his elderly grandparents who were hard of hearing.
Sure.
And that morning, he was on vacation because it's fall and he's a big hunter and he always goes hunting, but he took the vacation. He didn't go hunting. And he and his grandfather go to the firehouse where he's a volunteer fireman and a volunteer EMT. And at 6 a.m., you know, they're there at the firehouse washing his personal vehicle because it has mud on it. And he's there and takes the call that comes in that there is an emergency at this residence, which he recognizes as his residence. And so he is in an emergency vehicle and one of the first people to respond to the scene. The guy that's with him wasn't driving. Greg was driving, and he recalls very clearly having to tell Greg when they're speeding out of town towards their house, you know, shift the truck. You don't have it in the right gear. You got to put it in the right gear. you know, and they get out there, and as soon as he puts his feet on the ground, now, mind you, there's no call that has been made that says something's happened to Cheryl or a female is unresponsive or anything, and there's three little boys that live in the house and one has asthma, and Greg puts his feet on the ground and wants to know what she did now,
yeah.
You know. And so people at the scene who have now, you know, the neighbor is there too. He's an EMT. He knows prior stuff, and they are like keeping Greg away. And they run in the house through a garage and don't find Cheryl but bring the boys out and don't realize until like a second attempt into the house that she's in the garage. And there was a rope or a metal pipe over rafters in an opening in the garage where he used to hang and dress deer. And there was a nylon rope there. And at first they don't see anything, and there's a ladder there. But then there's Cheryl, you know, with her rear end on the floor, but her torso suspended about 6 inches from the ground with the rope wrapped real tight 3 times around her neck, you know, of looks like, you know, there's a ladder. Did she commit suicide? What happened? But she's laying on the ground, mm-hmm. you know. And so the county cops had come, but Greg's family was involved with the county police force. And so Illinois State Police had been called in for the crime scene. So, you know, this investigation starts, and to me and to others who knew the story of what Cheryl had been going through, there was no question. In the beginning, we never questioned any of it. Of course he was going to be arrested for her murder.
Right.
But that didn't happen right away.
What was one of the important things that was found on the floor in the pool area behind the door leading to the garage?
Well, there were a couple pieces of evidence that, to me, were just really telltale. And one of them was behind the door from the house to the garage, a used condom was found. So that was collected as evidence. You know, Greg later tried to allege that, oh, yeah, she just, you know, was having sex with people and would leave those lay around even though she had three boys. I mean, it was just, to me, that was absurd. And the other piece of evidence they found was a tip of a rubber glove and the wraps of rope around her neck, but yet she didn't have rubber gloves on. And then another little piece was found under the ladder. Another tip of the rubber glove was found under the ladder. And so with just, you know, those few little pieces of evidence, I'm like, oh my God, you should arrest him. He's killed her this time. I mean, we all know he tried to kill her a few weeks ago, and this time he was successful.
Sure.
But, you know, now we're a few weeks out, and no charges have been filed, and we're primarily worried about the kids and trying to get custody of them. And in Illinois at that time, even though Cheryl had been awarded custody, the final divorce decree had not been signed, so they were not divorced. And a living parent was, you know, they were like little pieces of property. They just automatically reverted to him because she's now dead. And at that time in Illinois, grandparents didn't have what we call standing, which is really the right to bring a suit if a parent was alive. You know, it was presumed in Illinois that the parent should have custody, not a grandparent.
Yeah.
And so we took the kids, we hid the kids out, and we went to court, and it was the same judge that had been involved in everything. And, you know, you have to know that this guy has now listened to her testimony, and he probably has a pretty good suspicion, too, of what happened. And he does award custody, temporary custody under a shelter care hearing to my parents. So we have temporary custody of the kids. So there's so much going on. We're trying to protect the children. We're trying to grieve. We're trying to bury my sister. He's not been arrested. We're terrified of him. We personally were afraid of him. We knew he had killed her. We're like, oh my God, and my parents were afraid of him. So there are just all these dynamics going on. It was, again, just intense and crazy. We'd live that, you know, a few weeks from I'm leaving him to he tries to kill her, to he kills her of intensity, and now it seems like it's starting all over again. And this time we're afraid for the children, we're afraid for ourselves.
Yeah.
So it was just crazy. And that aggravated criminal sexual assault case was pending, and it was supposed to be going to trial. And I had told the state's attorney, I'm like, well, you know, if you're not going to charge him with murder, you got to take this to trial. I mean, we know he did this. You can't let that go. And so he did take that to trial. There was a lot of publicity on it. It got moved to a different county. There was a lot of arguments over whether the jury should be told why the victim isn't at her trial. You know, well, of course you need to tell them. She's dead. She can't be there. She just, you know, you think, well, she doesn't want to cooperate. She doesn't want to pursue the charges, so she doesn't show up. No, she can't show up. She's dead. So finally the jury has read a statement that says she's deceased, but nothing else. That trial lasts a week, and he was acquitted. He was acquitted of those aggravated criminal sexual assault charges, and I think that's another instrumental part to me because I think the state's attorney was devastated. I'm sure he was. I was devastated. Mm-hmm. How could that have happened? How could the jury let him go?
Mm-hmm.
And back then, I don't ever remember. I don't think we ever talked to the jury or pulled the jury. I don't know anything. But I think that kind of played into the length of time because the state's attorney would say to me, Renee, there's no statute of limitations on murder, meaning if we don't arrest him in a year or 5 years or 10 years, it doesn't matter. You can always be arrested for murder.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how much time goes by. And he would say, you know, we believe other people are involved or know something and they're going to break and that's going to make the case. And that's when something's going to happen.
Yeah. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about, you thought that something was bound to happen. Roger Simpson, the state's attorney, says somebody's bound to say something. There's something could possibly happen. Now, let's fast forward to how many years it took and the different people involved. Tell us, fast forward to the events precipitating a change in the status of this case.
So, you know, we always wanted him to be arrested, but again, primary concern is get custody of the boys, filed the civil wrongful death case to gain custody, ultimately did get custody of the boys. My parents would go every year to the state's attorney and, you know, anything new in the case, anything going to happen, same old story, same old story. Now, Roger Simpson has retired, and his assistant takes over for a while, and then a young woman challenges him, the assistant, and becomes state's attorney. The interesting thing is this young woman, whose name is Dana Rhodes, was a senior at Illinois State University when Cheryl was killed, and she had had aspirations to go to law school and to be a state's attorney and even maybe a judge in that county. She'd had family that had done that, and she wanted to follow in those footsteps. And she remembered standing in her kitchen home on break and her parents talking about Cheryl's murder or Cheryl's death. And she remembers her parents saying that poor girl didn't commit suicide because Hauser's always said she committed suicide. You know, she was murdered. And Dana vowed at that time that if she ever did become state's attorney in that county and this case was still pending, she would solve it. She would take it to trial. And that's what she did. She became state's attorney. Unknown to us, she picked that case back up and started literally going through the file and dusting it off and working with the Illinois State Police and really getting the case ready to go to be charged and go to trial. We don't know any of this until she comes to me and says that she has picked the case back up and she needs DNA evidence from the boys. And I'm like, what? We're really this far along? And why would you need their DNA evidence? Well, there's a spot of blood that's been found on her nightgown, and we can't match now any DNA to anybody. You know, so who's, to right. her, that was the reasonable doubt that could be raised in the case, and she really wanted to nail that down, zip that up before she went to trial so she didn't have to worry about them saying, the killer's still out there, here's the blood, you know, and raising that reasonable doubt. And so then I'm left to call the boys who are, you know, now in their late 20s and who have never been told that we think their dad killed their mom, because you can't tell them that and then put them in a car and say have a good visit, because they were still having to visit him because he'd never been arrested or convicted. And we worked on that. We all started to get involved. I dusted out my files again. Dana literally made a personal trip to my home and picked up everything I had saved, and including boxes from Cheryl's divorce attorney who had passed away, and his, the guy's wife had given all the files to my parents. And now I'm reengaged, and we're going to, I think it's going to happen. It was terrifying. I had conversations with my sisters on, should we do this? Is it worth it? Can my parents take this? What if we go to trial and he's acquitted again? Is it worth it? Can we take it? You know, all these different emotions going through you and all these years. And it was what my mom had lived for, and justice mm-hmm. for her daughter, you know?
Yeah.
And to see that, and she's now in her 80s, and she didn't think she would ever see that. And so while they were afraid, we were all in. The whole family was in, and we're going to support the state's attorney and go forward with this. So by July of 2017, Greg had been arrested in, I think it was 2016, and the case went to trial. Almost 27 years to the date after her death, went to trial, and he was finally convicted.
Let's go backwards a little bit to this incredible trial, though. The mm-hmm. the one thing you find out many things in this, and one of the crucial things is we talked about this DNA and the reason mm-hmm. for the boys being tested, and you also say that one of the boys was vehement that he did not want to participate and he was going to get an attorney. So this is a disturbing event for him to consider. But there was also a person named Walt Rohr. Tell us about Walt Rohr and what Elizabeth what Elizabeth finds out and her boss about his role in this.
Yeah, so back then, the DNA evidence wasn't near as sophisticated as it is now. And they tested the DNA from the condom inside, outside, and there was just certain probability that you couldn't exclude either one of them. You know, it wasn't extremely conclusive. But now the DNA has changed when Dana and Elizabeth are ready to take this case to trial again, and they've sent it back into the crime lab. And now we know that the DNA on the inside is his, and on the outside, it's hers. So that was another instrumental piece of evidence in the trial, is that it's not all circumstantial. You have physical evidence now that connects him to the scene. And so this starts to come out about this DNA evidence, and when we were trying to figure out the DNA from the blood stain on the nightgown, there were lots of people who were requested to provide blood samples that had been around her, because it, you know, could have been the boys, it could have been my father, it could have been other male friends. And we had asked them, and people were very cooperative, and everybody was excluded. Walt Rohr, who had been in Mahomet, which is a neighboring town of former city of Mansfield on the fire department, but knew Greg and knew Cheryl and was a friend of Cheryl's, came forward to Elizabeth and was concerned that his DNA might be discovered. He didn't understand DNA, and he was concerned. And so he approached Elizabeth and confessed to her that he had had a sexual encounter with Cheryl once, that he was consoling her. And, you know, one thing led to another, and it went, you know, to the point where they had a sexual encounter. And he was concerned that perhaps they would find his DNA, and he didn't want to be accused of her murder. And so here we find out that I was adamant way back when Greg had been accusing her of having an affair that there's no way she had an affair, because when would she have time? I mean, she's working, she's got three boys, and she's fighting him off on all these different things. So we kind of had that to face. It was a little shocking at first, but then, you know, I had moments where I thought, well, good for her. I hope she had a one sexual encounter that wasn't just a flat rape, because so many of them that were chronicled in her journal were just, it was nothing but rape.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting fact that came out in the trial. But he, you know, he did testify, and the jury didn't, it wasn't his DNA. His DNA didn't match the spot on the nightgown, or, you know, in the condom or outside the condom or anything else. So he was never a suspect in the case. I felt bad for him, though. We didn't really know him, and I always wanted to talk to him. I did afterwards send him a thank you note, because I know from her notes and some notes that I found later that he listened to her, and I think he did provide her with a lot of empathy and compassion, and showed that to her. And up until the book was released, I had out on my list that I wanted to talk to him, but Walt has since passed away, so I will never get that opportunity.
Right. So tell us about the sentence, and tell us about his behavior. What did he act like throughout?
You know, he did not, he pled the fifth. He did not take the stand. I watched him intently during the trial because I wanted to see him and what he did. He wrote notes occasionally. He had little smirks on his face occasionally. There were really graphic photos when we got into the forensic expert testimony. I wanted to see what he would do. You know, what look would be on his face looking at those, or would he look at them? He had no problem staring right at the big screen where those pictures were being displayed without any look on his face, just nothing. And that always just was, I don't even know how to describe that, but how could you do that to somebody and then, you know, have had their three children with them and have no emotion, but there was nothing. Mm-hmm. And when he was convicted, there was really nothing from him. They led him away, put him in the police van outside. Sentencing hearing was scheduled. That was fascinating because you get to call witnesses for sentencing, and we got to read impact statements. And prior girlfriends came kind of out of the woodwork and testified at his sentencing hearing as to their subsequent relationships with him and their abuse, the abuse they suffered at his hands in subsequent relationships. It was really, I mean, I felt terrible for these women, but yet thankful that they came and testified on our behalf. And again, he has no emotion during any of this. Mm-hmm. My mom, who was 80 years old, read her own impact statement right there to the judge and just talked to him. It was amazing. She did an incredible job. And then at the end of it, she held up a big photograph of my sister in her nurse's outfit. And, you know, he just, nothing from him. But the judge was incredible and just very, you could tell he put so much time and attention and thought into every word he said during the entire trial and all of his motions and his final ruling for the sentencing. He had to be sentenced under the guidelines that were in place back then, so they were not near as strict as they would be today. But he calculated all the time that he had already served and that he might get for, good behavior and all these various credits that he could get against his sentence. And he sentenced him, it was actually 4 years ago, yesterday, the 6th of September, to 54 years in prison. And he explained that he came up with those 54 years because with all the credits that he could possibly get, he would have to spend at least 27 years behind bars. And the judge thought it was important that he spend 1 year behind bars for every year he'd walked free since he killed her.
Yeah.
And it's just an amazing end to the long story. And I think it was with that sentencing that these weights that we didn't even realize, I didn't realize that were sitting on my shoulders, just lifted. And my sisters and I look back and we say often that, you know, that sentence added 10 years to my mom and dad's life. And yeah. My mom has even said to me recently, it used to be that there wasn't a day that went by that she didn't think about Cheryl and have tears for Cheryl. And now some days go by and she doesn't even think about her.
Wow.
And it, you know, it's not because she's forgotten about her. It's just because it doesn't weigh on her like it used to. And you don't realize, we didn't realize how impactful it all was until it wasn't.
Yeah. And you capture that all that personal journey, keeping some of the information back from your parents because you didn't want to give them false hope. I want to thank you very much, Renee Fair, for coming on and talking about The Wheels of Justice, the true story of a 27-year battle to convict my sister's killer. I know that Brian Whitney helped out with this book, and I know it's a Wild Blue Press release. Is there a Facebook page for this? And is there any website people might find out more about this book?
Yes, Wild Blue Press has information under The Wheels of Justice. I have a website, reneefair.com, for fair advocacy and consultation. I do some advocacy for domestic violence, against domestic violence. And I have a Facebook business page under Fair Advocacy and Consultation. There's all kinds of information out there.
Yes. Thank you so much, Renee Fair, The Wheels of Justice, the true story of a 27-year battle to convict my sister's killer. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Renee. You have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you for having me. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.